Coming up on Weekend America.
Recounts drag on, appointments are debated, and Senate seats go unfilled. One former senator says, you ain't seen nothing yet.
Sitting around watching a senator polishing his halo at my expense, that wasn't a very fulfilling summer.
A look at the 1974 race that stretched into September. I'm John Moe, also returning to a seat in the pews after 17 years behind bars.
His eyes are so real. It doesn't matter what part of the church you're sitting in, you feel that Jesus is just staring down at you.
And you might be done with all that holiday food, but the fish are just getting started.
So here's cinnamon. Here's the one day after Thanksgiving. The amount of cinnamon nearly doubles.
You didn't throw it away, you just put it back into the ecosystem. Weekend America, after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe in St. Paul. The Minnesota Vikings are out of the NFL playoffs, but I'm going to watch the game tomorrow between the San Diego Chargers and the Pittsburgh Steelers. Why? Darren Sproles. Did you see this guy last week? He's 5'6", 180 pounds, a backup running back, a nobody. But last week, returning punts and kicks, starting for the injured LaDainian Tomlinson, Sproles busted out for 328 total yards by himself. He's 5'6". I love that. I bet Darren Sproles has no idea that he's become an inspirational metaphor for America. Well, maybe he does. I love football. So, Sproles is in Pittsburgh. What are you doing this weekend?
Oh, I'm watching some basketball.
I'm going to a board game party.
Then I'm going to a going away party for a coworker who's actually going to Israel.
I'm going to a company holiday party, unfortunately.
I wouldn't mind seeing Gran Torino.
I'm going to cap off Saturday with some bowling with a friend for a birthday.
I'm cleaning my apartment.
Probably just hanging out with friends.
Probably reading comics and drawing and drinking coffee. And eating pizza and burritos.
I have a bass lesson on Sunday, so I have a jam-packed weekend. I don't know how I'm going to fit it all in.
Busy Americans. Those voices came from Brooklyn, Chicago, and Lincoln, Nebraska. The 98 members of the U.S. Senate got to work this week. Yep, 98. Barack Obama's former seat in Illinois is still vacant. Earlier this week, Roland Burris, the man picked by now impeached Illinois Governor Rod Blagojevich, showed up to present his Senate credentials, but he wasn't seated, at least not yet. Here in Minnesota, officials declared Democrat Al Franken the winner by 225 votes. Republican incumbent Norm Coleman is now suing. The fate of that Senate seat may take months to resolve. Now, that might seem crazy, months, but it's nothing compared to 1974. That was a year for crazy. In August 1974, Richard Nixon resigned amid the Watergate scandal, and then the craziness spilled into the midterm elections in November. In the New Hampshire Senate race, Republican Louis Wyman defeated Democrat John Durkin by 355 votes. Durkin demanded a recount, which showed him winning by 10. Then the state's ballot law commission stepped in and examined the results, and on Christmas Eve 1974, it declared Wyman the winner again by 2. The Republican governor declared Wyman New Hampshire's new senator, but Durkin wasn't about to let that happen. I reached John Durkin at his home in Manchester.
My recollection is that both the Louis Wyman, who was the Republican that I was running against, the both of us wanted the Senate to take a look at it. You know, I'm not sure that Louis was as vocal on that issue as I was, but I think deep down inside, neither of us wanted to be there with a checkered flag flying behind us. I mean, the Senate's a tough enough job if you're there with full credentials. If you're there on a rain check, you know, it's pretty near impossible.
So the Senate agreed to examine the recount. It went to the Rules Committee. At the time, 5 Democrats and 3 Republicans. Wyman and Durkin both presented their versions of what was wrong with the recount. The disputed ballots were brought down to Washington, but the committee kept deadlocking. Winter dragged into summer. Nothing was getting resolved. John Durkin says CBS News correspondent Roger Mudd summarized it best.
One day Roger walks by and he says, "Hey, Durkin, don't you realize that neither side wants you?" And I said, "What the hell do you mean?" He said, "Well, If you get seated, the Republicans lose members on four of the major committees. The Democrats have already got, without you, they've already got a veto-proof majority.
Summer comes, and the Senate still hasn't solved this thing. Republicans seek to have the seat vacated and call for a new election. Most accounts say Durkin resisted. He remembers it otherwise. But at any rate, there was a runoff on September 16th, 1975, and Durkin won by 27,000 votes. Durkin lost his bid for re-election in 1980, the year of Ronald Reagan. Louis Wyman died nearly 7 years ago. John Durkin is now a retired attorney, and he's been watching the Illinois and Minnesota Senate battles with a lot of interest.
The only advice I would have, and I really don't see any need for it from what their record is don't let the exasperation of the situation push you into saying something that you're going to regret later on.
And Durkin says it's actually a good thing the process in Minnesota is taking so long. Democracy can be slow, he says, but it's better than rushing the outcome.
My mother used to say, haste makes waste. But haste may not make waste, but haste may rob a number of people of their constitutional right to get an answer about who won. And they don't want to give that away.
A few years after the ordeal, the Senate History Office interviewed Floyd Riddick, who was Senate parliamentarian back in 1974. He remembered the months of poring over scrawled ballots from New Hampshire and prayed that the Senate would never, ever get involved in a state recount again. His conclusion? He said Shakespeare had a play entitled, which is very suitable for this, Much Ado About Nothing. So keep that in mind when you finally get out of court, Al Franken and Norm Coleman. As bad as this is, it could get worse. Because it already has. Barack Obama's pick for head of Homeland Security, Arizona Governor Janet Napolitano, faces confirmation hearings in the Senate in the coming week. Now, she's known as a pragmatist on immigration and has questioned whether the wall being built along the Mexican border will do any good. Immigration is an abstract issue for some, but it's part of daily life for others. Cintide Narvaez lives on the American side of the Rio Grande. For her, that river has always been a fun way to visit her neighbors in border towns on the Mexican side of the border. And that changed after the September 11th attacks. The U.S. government closed the border, and the cross-border trade that Mexican towns depended on completely dried up. Narvaez saw her neighbors' and friends' lives fall apart, and now she's trying to help heal that wound. Weekend America's Michael May has her story.
From here in Texas, you can wade across the Rio Grande to Boquillas del Carmen, Mexico. Until recently, you could take a ferry across and back.
Yeah, let's do those first.
But today, a group of rugged bohemian types load up a canoe with bags of cotton fabric and boxes of solar panels. The river is now a one-way street going south. You can be arrested if you try and come back. Cintide Narvaez is a lanky 48-year-old with long, gray-streaked brown hair and sun-weathered skin. She's made the trip to Boquillas every month since September, acting as life support for the town.
We interacted with these people. We went to the same dances. We had the same funerals. You know, we had a huge friendship day in the park. These are people that were my neighbors. So it seemed to me, since I'm not married and I don't have kids and I don't have a job, and I had the time and the energy to try to do something.
Cinta was a river guide for more than 20 years. But over the past decade, a case of severe rheumatoid arthritis began to ravage her body, and she now lives on disability. Still, she seems to have more energy than most healthy people. Once we get to town, she starts to give a tour. Boquillas is perched on a hill, offering a panoramic view of relentless desert. The place is almost a ghost town. There's a large boarded-up restaurant called Falcone's, a row of half-completed houses, and a courtyard full of abandoned trucks. It's hard to imagine the glory days.
It was full of people eating at Falcone's, checking out different houses and talking to different people, children running around trying to sell bracelets, tons of people in the bar.
The economy of three towns along the border here were wiped out in a single day in May of 2002 when the informal border crossings were shut down. Within a few months, the population of Boquilla shrank from 250 people to 90. Other towns fared even worse and became shelters for drug smugglers. We stop at a small food market run out of the adobe home of Maria de la Luz Chavez Moran. She says that before the border closed, she would make around $1,000 a month. Now she sells food on credit. And she says the damage has been more than economic. When there was plenty of work, people cooperated. But now the desperation has turned neighbors against each other.
Now some want to earn more money because there's no way to make a living. And when they get it, they want it all for themselves. They don't want to share it with others because of the situation here.
Maria's friend Cinta is slowly getting people to work together. This time she's brought a water pump to irrigate a community garden. She's buying crafts from the villagers.
Yo damo $5 cada todas esas cosas.
Ajá.
Hay 14.
Ah, bueno.
Okay? Mm-hmm. Y, 15. Mm-hmm. Okay?
Cinta's money helps, but it's not enough to survive. Some of the men in town work as firefighters. And one Boquillas man, Victor Valdez, has found another way to attract tourist dollars down by the river. Victor was one of the boatmen who used to ferry tourists across the river, singing along the way. Nowadays, Victor makes the hour-long trek to Boquillas Canyon, wades into the muddy water, and serenades the amber-hued chasm. A group of Gore-Tex-clad hikers stop to listen on the U.S. side. Victor's left a tip jar over there. The hikers put $4 in and continue on their way. There is only one bus a week out of Boquillas.
Can't put it any higher.
Cinta struggles on board with 15 quilts, 250 carved walking sticks, and several boxes of copper critters. Her face is starting to show exhaustion from the trip.
You have such serious health problems. How do you do this?
I was in bed too long. I was in bed too long, and there's more to me than that. And yes, sometimes I feel absolutely terrible, but then you lie in bed and you bargain. Please, if you just let me feel a little bit better, I will do something. Please. That's why this is not, you know, Cinta helping them. This is really a win-win in both sides. I need something, too.
And that something involves a grueling journey home. We could wade across the river and be back at Cinta's place in an hour. Instead, we'll spend 10 hours getting to the legal point of entry, another 3 hours getting the crafts through customs, and then 6 hours back to Cinta's house. And she'll do it all over again in a few weeks. Just south of the U.S.-Mexican border, I'm Michael May for Weekend America.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week.
When Antonia finally got out of prison, there was one place she wanted to go more than any other, her old church. Walk through it with her next on Weekend America. Thank you. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. This weekend, like every weekend, thousands of people will crowd into Detroit's Most Holy Redeemer Church. The century-old building was once home to the largest Catholic parish in North America, with 4,000 active families. At the turn of the last century, the parish was predominantly Irish. Today, more than 5,000 people attend Mass there, most of them for services in Spanish. But 35-year-old Antonia Bunton considers going to church a special privilege, one she had to earn back.
On Saturdays, I get to go to church with my family, to the church that I grew up in. And it's something that I look forward to all week. My Holy Redeemer Church is so beautiful. It was built in the 1900s, and it's amazingly beautiful. When you walk in, the floors are marble, and right in the middle where the priest stands, there's this big fountain. In the middle of it is a crucifix, and then there's like a gazebo around the crucifix and flowers, bouquets of flowers all around it. And then the ceiling that's over the gazebo, it's a painting of Jesus. And his eyes are so... His eyes are so real. It doesn't matter what part of the church you're sitting in. When you sit there, you feel that Jesus is just staring down at you. When I was a little girl, we lived across the street from the church. I used to go to the church and go in the garden and talk to God. If my mom and my dad used to fight, that made me sad as a little girl. Or financially it was hard for us. And I remember being sad. That was a place where I could go and talk to God and ask God to make things better. And I felt, when I went there, I felt God's presence. And that's the same feeling I get today. When I was 17, I took 3 boys to sell marijuana to 2 other boys. And I dropped them off. I was supposed to drive around the block and come back and pick them up. But halfway around the block, I heard gunshots. And I did not go back because there wasn't supposed to be gunshots, and I was scared. I did not think that anyone would get hurt. I did not think anything would happen other than it would be a drug deal and I was going to get $50. The marijuana deal turned armed robbery, turned murder. One boy was shot and killed, and another one was shot and he has permanent injuries. He's paralyzed. I received 25 to 50 years. In prison, the Mass was in a classroom in the education building, and a priest would come in and he followed the regular format for a Mass. It usually lasted about a half an hour, 45 minutes, and we all prayed together, and it was very nice. But I always thought about my church, my Holy Redeemer Church, and I always thought about how beautiful it was and how I couldn't wait to go back. The first time I walked into Holy Redeemer Church after being in prison for 17 years, I was overwhelmed. That first Mass there, after I got out, I was overwhelmed. I want to help people by letting them know what could happen, specifically young people, to let them know that the people they're around, they have to be very careful, the people that they associate with, because whatever happens, they can be held accountable for what someone else does, whether they intended it or not. And so that's what I, when I talk to God, I tell God, I cannot directly help those people I hurt so bad. And I may never be able to tell them how sorry I am. But what I can do is I can use my life for a purpose greater than myself. And that's what I ask God. Use me for something bigger than myself. It's like you're resting on a cloud. That's how I feel. You know, when they sing during church, they sound like angels. And I feel like I'm in heaven when I'm there.
Weekend America's Desiree Cooper brought us that story. While still in prison, Antonia became the first woman in her family to graduate from college. While there, she also became a certified AIDS counselor, a drug counselor, and a paralegal. For the past 10 years, she has been an activist for female prisoners who are sexually abused by prison personnel. The governor of the state of Michigan commuted her 25 to 50-year sentence in the fall. In addition to telling her life story to students, she is now working and getting a graduate degree in public administration. She hopes to run a nonprofit for at-risk youth. Meet Antonia and go to her church with her at our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, KPCC Los Angeles, and KUOW Seattle, and is made possible in part by the University of Washington Foster School of Business Executive MBA program.
You can flush that old food down the sink, you can put it in the garbage, but you're not making it disappear. You're just serving it to fish. Ahead on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. And it's time for your letters. We recently talked to Charles Womack on the Weekend Soundtrack part of our show. Charles is a mountain bike enthusiast who's recovering from a stroke and just now getting back in the saddle. His story inspired Sarah Benson to write in about her own recovery.
When I heard the story, it reminded me of myself. I was in a pretty serious bike accident, and I broke my leg, and there was a steel rod implanted. I spent 4 months on crutches. My goal for 2009 is to try and run a half marathon.
Good luck, Sarah. Now, last week on the show, we had the recording artist Girl Talk, a.k.a. Greg Gillis, in the studio, and I talked with him about his latest album. Greg constructs songs on his computer using samples of other songs, and I don't mean he has samples in his songs. His songs are built entirely out of hundreds of other previously recorded songs. Now, often these are well-known, popular tracks. We mentioned last week that Greg sells his music only through non-traditional channels because he never gets legal permission for any of the samples he uses. Several of our listeners were very concerned about this point. Alva Kulnane writes, "Weekend America's decision to condone theft is deplorable. Music sampling without the owner's permission, which would likely include compensation, is illegal, plain and simple. Music is property. In the future, I hope you'll use more discretion in your choice of stories, especially stories that condone the theft of property." Intellectual property wasn't the focus of the story last week, but I did ask Greg Gillis why he chooses not to pay royalties to the artists he samples. Here's part of what he had to say.
And for an album where you're going to have 300 samples, if you wanted to go the traditional route and pay royalties to all of those artists, we'd have to sell each copy for a few hundred dollars just to pay back the artist.
So is Greg's decision criminal behavior, or is it just a sign of things to come in the world of music? For a little insight, we called up Kristen Thompson, Education Director for the Future of Music Coalition. It's a nonprofit that deals with issues at the intersection of music, technology, policy, and law. Kristen, welcome to Weekend America.
Thank you, John.
Is Greg Gillis engaged in theft?
It's hard to say. There is a legal question there. The things I've read from Greg Gillis and his label, they're trying to take a fair use defense in the rationale for how they decided not to clear the samples.
So is there such a thing as a fair use law, or is it all case by case and open to interpretation?
It is all case by case and open to interpretation.
As you observe the future of music from your vantage point at the Future of Music Coalition, is this an important test case? Is Girl Talk going to be talked about years from now?
I am not sure if Girl Talk might be, but I think what this points out to is that the sample license clearance process that exists now is inefficient and cumbersome. Now, that doesn't mean that people should just avoid it because it's inefficient and cumbersome. It does, though, have us start to think about how we can make it more efficient so that the barriers to having people clear samples properly were reduced to the point where there's less friction and there's more chances for actually people to license and talk to the people who actually own the rights to the records.
So, Kristen, it sounds like Greg may be engaged in theft or may not be. It depends on the concept of fair use, which has no legal definition and would depend on an individual court case, should any cases be brought to court, which thus far none have been against Greg, so we just don't know.
That's a good summary.
Well, good to know we've worked all that out. Kristen Thompson from the Future of Music Coalition, thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you have any ideas on how to streamline bureaucratic processes, some landmark legal decisions, some precedents you want to pass along, or any other insights you'd like to share with us, send them our way. Go to weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. We're continuing our Weekend Shift series today with a story about Mark Lundquist. He's a police officer for the city of St. Paul, Minnesota, and he started his career over 20 years ago in Dallas. Since then, he has been a bike cop, he's patrolled a housing project, he's even been a member of the Mounted Police, up on a horse. Now he patrols the streets in a cruiser, and our producer Mark Sanchez rode along with him on a recent Sunday.
It's a chilly Sunday morning. The sun is just about to rise, and Mark Lundquist and his fellow police officers file in for their morning briefing.
There was a shooting yesterday.
The chief gives a rundown of what's been happening in their precincts since they last clocked out. The list is brutal.
There's some information about a deal where a guy jumped off the Robert Street Bridge. A couple of robbery.
People always talk about that officer that they get a ticket from. And they always say, he was so mean. He was so cranky. And I have to remind them, how would you feel if every morning you started your work hearing about the guy that was killed, or the guy, the burglars that are wanted that you've been chasing around the city for the last 20 years, and they're the same ones. And it's hard not to have a real cynical attitude. Vast majority of cops are a cynical group. They have to be.
It's obvious that Mark can be the friendly neighborhood cop. But at about 6'3", and with the build of a quarterback, his size can be a little off-putting. As we hit the streets in his cruiser, Mark is cracking jokes and working to put me at ease. The onboard laptop and dispatches from three radios provide a constant din of beeps and static clutter. It's about 7:30 in the morning when we get our first call of the day. The alarm at a health club has been tripped, a possible forced entry. Mark hits the lights and guns it. We're doing close to 60 miles an hour in a 30-mile-an-hour zone. And except for the other drivers who aren't getting out of the way, this is cool.
Nobody pulls to the right anymore. They stop in the middle of the road, they pull to the left, you never know what they're going to do.
We arrive at the health club, and Mark's not smiling anymore. He's got his game face on. We enter through the back door. The cops have their hands on the holsters.
Where they went to, but they should be around here somewhere.
Nothing seems out of the ordinary, though.
Door doesn't look like
false alarm. After we leave the scene, it's clear to me how vigilant Mark is all the time. His eyes are constantly scanning the streets for anything out of the ordinary.
If we go out to dinner with my family, I can't sit at a table with my back to the door. I'm definitely aware of my surroundings, and it's a conscious thing. But at the same time, when I'm at home, some of the cop comes out of me sometimes if I have to discipline my kids. Sometimes that cop in me will come out, and I have to bring myself back and just take a deep breath and let my wife handle it.
At home, Mark's wife and two kids are getting ready to spend the day with Grandma. He's out looking for criminals. But the weekend beat does have some advantages.
It's kind of a love-hate relationship, because all those people that were doing bad things on, like, a Friday, partying and whipping it up and getting into trouble and everything else, now they're all sleeping in, and then none of them wake up until about 11 o'clock or so. Those are, people are working in the yards today. People are out doing stuff. So I see and deal with more of the good crowd. I get to stop and talk to the guy raking his yard and just talk.
There's a little downtime and we stop off at a local cafe. Mark strikes up a conversation with the cashier. The next call comes in. Shots fired. We head to the car. My heart rate doubles as I realize we are purposely heading towards gunshots.
Wearing dark clothing, black hooded sweatshirts, and black pants. The gun was a semi-automatic handgun. They left on foot in unknown direction from the...
Mark steers into an alley behind an apartment building.
Strack!
Cops are found out everywhere, searching for evidence.
Where are the rounds at so I don't run over them? That end?
Shells are being plucked from garage doors and nearby parked cars. 11 bullets were fired, and none of them struck the intended victim. He's off to the side, giving a statement while Mark takes pictures and chats up another cop.
He's a very lucky man.
Should be going to your church.
I know who he ripped off or whose daughter he's dating.
Oh, absolutely.
Mark cracks a smile. It's a bit odd at a crime scene, but that's how he keeps the cynicism at bay. We get back in the car a little after noon, and the bad guys are definitely awake now. From St. Paul, I'm Mark Sanchez for Weekend America.
182, copy.
There are no dispatches coming out of what Officer Lundquist calls his good time radio. That's the radio he turns on to listen to shows like The Splendid Table and, of course, Weekend America. Hey, Mark. Check out pictures of Officer Lundquist in action at weekendamerica.org. So the holidays are over and your body is glad. All those cookies, the rich fatty foods, the nog. Tasty, sure, but you know it's not good for you. So maybe you've joined a gym, started a healthy new diet, done something to get rid of all that toxic stuff. But the salmon in Puget Sound in Washington State don't really have that option. See, they're getting a lot of that food once you're done with it. From Seattle, Joshua McNichols has our story.
My hand is freezing. It's so cold.
Leanna Singh leans over a dock. She dips a plastic bottle into a tributary that feeds Puget Sound. She's helping the group Sound Citizen look for flavors in the water. Cinnamon and vanilla, sage and rosemary. All the stuff we ate during the holidays. Test tubes of water are fed into a mass spectrometer back at the University of Washington. Jackie Neibauer is the group's analyst.
So here's cinnamon. Here's the one day after Thanksgiving. The amount of cinnamon nearly doubles. And then 4 days after Thanksgiving is when we see the spike. And then it kind of tapers off and goes back to a baseline of zero.
There's another pulse of cinnamon before Christmas, following everyone's office parties. Jackie calculated how many cookies people would need to eat in order to put that much flavor into the water.
During the holiday season, there's about 250,000 cookies per day going into Puget Sound. That means that the average person is eating about 2 cookies per day.
But doesn't our sewage get cleaned up? Well, yes, but Jackie says it's more complicated than that. And that's how I ended up on a giant catwalk at King County's West Point Sewage Treatment Plant.
We add a whole lot of bacteria. It makes it brown. We add oxygen. It makes it bubbly. This right here is a big cleaning party.
Tour guide Casey Plank shows me one of the last defenses before our chemical waste goes back into the Sound. It's a giant cesspool of bacteria.
They may break something down. They may not. You have to assume that what's going down your drain is going to make a stop at a treatment plant, but then it's going to go back out. There is no magic happening here. Nothing just disappears. It is well known that if we're testing water from sewer lines, you are going to find aspirin, medicines, cleaning products, anything you can test for, you're going to find it.
In a typical sample from Puget Sound, we'll see 200 or 300 different chemicals that are in the water sample.
That's Rick Kyle. He's an oceanographer and a founder of Sound Citizen, the volunteer group we met before. He wants to know what's killing Puget Sound. In the last couple of years, the Sound has developed huge dead zones. Bottom-feeding fish are turning into hermaphrodites and can't reproduce. Orca whales are dying in unprecedented numbers. It's really hard to pinpoint specific causes, but Kyle suspects it has to do with all the chemicals in the water. And the chemicals are coming from us.
It's hard to think that just living your average life is having some harmful impact somewhere. The initial reaction was often, I don't want to hear about that. It makes me depressed.
But then Kyle had the idea of testing for spices. Now when he and his students go around to schools, they can talk about the cinnamon-flavored waters of Puget Sound. He waits for the audience to make the connection to the more toxic chemicals in our daily lives.
We can talk about the impact we have on the environment without feeling sad. It's not about everything being bad. It's about thinking thinking of the connected nature of the earth and thinking about the ramifications of everything that we do.
Then he tells folks to read labels and avoid certain ingredients. People can also take their expired drugs, even aspirin, back to a pharmacy instead of flushing them down the toilet. And if they want to, they can join his volunteer army of sample collectors. Out on the dock, I ask him the question that no journalist can resist. Do the salmon caught during a spike in cinnamon taste better? Rick looks out at the water. Then he says he doesn't eat these fish. They're too contaminated. In Seattle, I'm Joshua McNichols for Weekend America.
Rick Kyle says one flavor in particular dominates Puget Sound, artificial vanilla. There's also a lot of caffeine in there. So basically the fish are swimming around in a giant diluted latte, which one could argue is what Seattle is kind of like on a rainy day. You can find a lot more information about toxic daily chemicals to avoid at weekendamerica.org. Our weather person Jeannie Yandel lives in western Washington, where heavy snowfall in recent weeks has led to heavy flooding this week. Fortunately, her microphone still works, and she has a look at weather and fun for this weekend.
Most drivers avoid skidding their cars across the ice, but not the good folks of Merrill, Wisconsin. They embrace losing control of their vehicles at the ice drag races. 9 degrees to slide your automobile across an icy lake. Racing cars on a lake covered in ice. What could possibly go wrong there? No, I can't foresee a single safety issue. Rock on, Merrill. The holidays are over, right? Maybe for humans, says Sioux Falls, South Dakota, but what about the oddly timed Christmas with the animals? 19 and sunny to watch zoo critters open their Christmas presents. Come back later for search for gift receipts to return stuff with the animals. Santa, of course the penguins already have tuxedo t-shirts and Happy Feet DVDs. Maybe just bring them fish next year. The thing about snow is it melts when exposed to heat. Bend, Oregon overlooks that fact for Bonfire on the Snow. Cloudy and 26 for snowshoeing, warming up by the bonfire, and seriously wet feet. This sounds like a great event up until the melting. What about calling it Bonfire on the Snow and Post-Bonfire Puddle Stomp? Or Bonfire on the Snow and Slush Appreciation Fiesta? Sell the melting, Bend. For more information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm Jeannie Yandel for Weekend America.
Justin's parents had a problem. The slightest injury to their boy could be catastrophic, but he still wanted to play sports. Their solution, ahead on Weekend America. From American Public Media, it's Weekend America. I'm John Moe. Basketball season is underway for kids around the country. In Delaware, one team of elementary students begins practice this weekend at the Glasgow Reformed Presbyterian Church. Parents can expect their kids to come home with scrapes, bruises, the occasional sprained elbow or jammed finger. For one family, the consequences can be much more severe. Even the slightest injury to 8-year-old Justin Henke can inflame a dormant and destructive disease that lurks within his genes. Reporter Cary Gren spent a day with the Henkes to find out how they make it through sports seasons.
At a pool in Newark, Delaware, a dozen kids leap in for swim practice.
All right, everybody get a kickboard and throw your noodles back by the wall.
So you're supposed to jump in and then do what? Switch hands with a little noodle.
And swim all the way across?
Yeah.
For the most part, 8-year-old Justin looks just like the other kids, except for a striking crookedness to his big toes.
At birth, actually, the pediatrician at the hospital had noticed, and we had noticed too, the peculiar big toes that he had.
That's Wendy Hankey, Justin's mom.
And the pediatrician said, well, typically if there's a symmetric abnormality like that, that it might indicate a genetic condition.
The Hankeys were living in Baltimore at the time. Justin was an infant. They took him to Johns Hopkins for an evaluation, but the doctors couldn't diagnose him. Over the next 6 years, there were other signs something was wrong.
For instance, when he was crawling, he couldn't lift his head up to see where he was going. So, you know, well, he modified and did the butt scoot. And two, just with getting dressed, he has a limited range of motion in his elbows. But, you know, we just get him some bigger shirts.
It was nagging in the back of your head, like, what exactly is this?
Justin's father, Kevin.
I remember going to amusement parks and water slides and trying to notice people's toes to see if anybody else had that same thing. And yeah, it always in the back of your mind, kind of gnawing at you, what could be.
And then one night, a couple years ago, Wendy was up late.
I shouldn't have been reading online. I should have been in bed. And I just happened to notice on Yahoo News, one of these peculiar news items that said gene discovered for rare stone man's disease. And I mean, I just clicked on it out of curiosity and... it just sent chills right through my body as I read each paragraph, and I just knew that this is what it was, even though I didn't want it to be.
Stoneman's disease, also known as fibrodysplasia ossificans
progressiva, a scary medical name. It's a scary disease, too.
Fred Kaplan, a professor at the University of Pennsylvania, was the scientist who found the gene for this disease. He's Justin's doctor and the doctor to all 700 people in the world who have what most people in the field refer to as FOP.
So a child is born with normal muscles, and then one morning they wake up, maybe they bruise themselves or injured themselves, or just a little bang or bruise or something on the playground the day before. And then the next day or a couple days later, this metamorphosis begins to occur. And within several weeks, what was once a muscle now becomes a bone.
Did you catch that? Just a little bruise, or sometimes being sick from the flu, and muscle turns to bone.
And if you try to remove this extra bone, it leads to catastrophic explosions of new bone formation. So surgery is not an answer.
Eventually, that newly formed bone locks the person into a second skeleton. But it's not the type of skeleton you or I have. It's a highly deformed one, and it twists the body into sometimes painful poses. Justin's muscles haven't yet started their transformation. For him, FOP is more a lifestyle restriction than a disease.
Could you tell me what it is for people who don't know?
Well, we can't do, like, rough things like football and doing headstands or handstands.
Justin's parents say they don't know how much he grasps about FOP, just that he knows he has special bones and has to be careful not to get injured.
You know, he's a good reader, so he's seen a lot of literature lying around, so I think he understands that, there's potential that, you know, he could have extra bone for him, but we really haven't discussed in detail with him the ramifications or what could happen, because we don't really know. Nobody really knows.
So far, Justin's FOP has been mild, and the Hankeys are hopeful that maybe it'll stay that way. But FOP is referred to as a sleeping giant, ready to spring into action when the right trigger comes along. One boy lost all movement in his neck after just 1 week of painful swellings. The shoulders of another girl, by the time she was a teenager, had twisted nearly perpendicular to her hips. You might think parents of a kid who has this in their future would want to keep them in a bubble, but Justin's parents restrict him very little.
I like to play basketball, soccer, swimming. No, I really want to do tennis.
At swim practice, Coach Sandy White says he doesn't go out of his way to treat Justin differently.
You know, we tend to keep our eye on him, but he dives without any problem and swims all the strokes. He's doing good.
Still, there's something lurking inside of Justin that could be awakened by an activity like swimming. But his parents have chosen not to watch over his every move. After about 20 minutes, Wendy leaves swim practice. She goes for a jog as the kids do laps, while her husband, Kevin, he's at the office.
FOP patients, they need to be able to enjoy their childhood because that might be the most freedom they have in their lifetime.
And this weekend, freedom for Justin means shooting hoops. In Philadelphia, I'm Carrie Grenz for Weekend America.
Justin's team starts practice this weekend. When Justin's not feeling well or in pain, he serves as the assistant manager instead of being on the court. To learn more about FOP and research for a cure using Justin's baby teeth, go to weekendamerica.org. And that wraps up another hour. And America, do you have a minute? Because we need to talk. Just before Christmas, we got some bad news here at Weekend America. Pretty much the worst news you can get if you're a radio show. We got canceled. Our last show will be January 31st, so we have 3 more weeks together after this. There are lots of reasons leading to this, of course. We're a big, ambitious 2-hour show. We hire excellent freelancers all over the country. We have a dedicated staff of producers, editors, reporters, engineers. We sweat the details to make the show sound as good as it can. All that ain't cheap. And in case you haven't noticed, the economy does not smile on media operations lately as it is. We'll all move on to some other things, but we're heartbroken not to be together after January, and we're heartbroken to not be working with you after January as well. But look, we have a few more weekends to hang out together. Are there any stories you want to hear one more time? Anything else you want us to know? Get in touch with us through weekendamerica.org. We'll be okay. Radio will be okay. The economy will recover. Everything will eventually be fine. And it's okay to be sad. We're sad too. There's some good group therapy going on our Facebook page, by the way. You can check that out. You can download a free podcast of the entire show at weekendamerica.org. I'm John Moe. Bye now.
Weekend America is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and by the Poetry Foundation, in support of poetry on American public media programs. More information online at poetryfoundation.org. This program is also made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
The weekend is the perfect time to sit back and reflect.
There is some kind of sense of isolation and desolation that makes it like a dream moving around in some of these landscapes.
Look, traveling all across this nation can get expensive. Let us do it for you. I'm John Moe, host of Weekend America. Every week we take you across the country and show you what your friends and neighbors are doing and thinking. Join us.